How you need to do it. Scoping and planning a project in a day. 1. Identify the people you will need. 2. Get them to do their preparation prior to the one-day session. 3. Consolidate this work into draft versions of the scope and plan documents. 4. Run the one-day session to the timetable above and complete the two documents. 5. Do a final tidy-up of the documents after the one-day session. 3. Calculate the value of getting it done early. Since people generally don't believe that projects can be done early, they don't bother to look at what the financial impact might be. If they did, they might be astonished at what they discovered, and, as a result, there could be huge incentive to get the project done early. What you need to do next is produce a simple profit model for a project development project. It will show you the cost of developing the product versus the revenues that are projected to be achieved. Having built such a model, it is possible for the project manager and the stakeholders to examine what the effect of finishing early would be. Could they charge a higher price for their product because it's on the market earlier? As a result, could they grab a bigger market share? Could being to market early mean that the product's lifetime will be extended? So, for example, they could see what the effect of shortening the project by 3 months, charging $400 per unit instead of $350, assuming a 5% higher market share and an additional quarter's sales but at reduced volume, would be. In this example, the profit before tax, PBT, would be $29,940,000 for the unshortened project and $30,240,000 for the shortened project, an additional $300,000. Equally, they could look at the negative scenario. What if the project runs late? What if it ran over by 3 months? Then the revenues would be delayed by 3 months and the costs would continue for a further 3 months. This would cause the PBT to drop from $29,940,000 to $24,350,000, a loss of over $5.5 million. So, there would be a big incentive to see that this project wasn't delayed. 4. Lay the plan out as a strip board. It's already been said that people who run movie projects are good project managers. These people can take a project, delivering a product that is part art, part science, and deliver it on time, within budget, to a very high degree of quality, and they can do this predictably over and over again. This being the case, then, there is much to be learned from them about how to run projects properly. If you ever hear a movie person talking about the shooting of a movie, you'll often hear them say something like, "It was a 79-day shoot." Now, when's the last time you heard a project manager say, "It was a 79-day project"? More often, you're likely to hear them say, "Where did the week go? And what did we achieve?" Movie people are completely focused on keeping the number of days shooting their movie as short as possible. There is a very simple reason for this. It's because shooting movies is very expensive. Each day costs a small fortune, so the more the number of days shooting can be kept to a minimum, the cheaper the movie will be to make. So, if you want to learn how to shorten projects or shorten time to market, it's good to know that the problem has already been solved. Movie people have solved it. They know how to run projects in the shortest possible time. Furthermore, the key to it is terribly simple. They merely break everything down to the day level of detail, as opposed to the 1 to 5 days described in Chapter 2. When movie people plan the shooting of a movie, they use what is known as a strip board. Think of a strip board as being like a giant spreadsheet. The rows of the spreadsheet are the days of the shoot. The first series of columns in the spreadsheet list all of the cast members, from the highest paid star to the lowest walk-on part. The remaining columns list all of the other things: props, special effects, animals, special services, equipment, and so on, required to shoot on that particular day. Months before a movie is due to be shot, somebody goes through the script, the definition of the goal, and creates a strip board for the movie. The strip board essentially shows what every member of the team is doing every day of the project. Get the idea? So, if you want to get your project done in the shortest possible time, as cheaply as possible, with the minimum of delays and waste, plan it down to the day level of detail and document it on a strip board. Who said it? You may delay, but time will not. Benjamin Franklin. 5. Do a mission briefing for the team and for the stakeholders. The idea of a mission briefing is taken from those old black and white movies about World War II bombing missions, where the bomber crews are taken through the plan by their management. What a mission briefing means in this context is to take the team through the project plan line by line, asking them to look for opportunities to shorten the project. It is almost inevitable that they will come up with some. Exactly the same, but this time the audience is the stakeholder. While they may be less likely to find opportunities for shortening the project, a mission briefing can be a good way of showing them why what they're asking you to do is impossible. 6. Make every day count. In Fred Brooks's The Mythical Man Month, see Chapter 1, the author poses the question, how did the project get to be late? The answer being, the project got to be late one day at a time. Well, the project also gets to be early one day at a time. If you think in terms of spending each day wisely, making every day count, you will find that opportunities to shorten the project will present themselves as the project unfolds. Here are 8 specific things that you can do. 1. Don't do it tomorrow if it can be done today. Encourage an attitude of, can I finish this today? 2. Encourage everybody to be hypersensitive to changes that increase the scope of the project. 3. If team members find themselves waiting for somebody else, get them to raise an alert. 4. If team members are aware of a potential delay coming up, flag it as soon as it's known. 5. Keep dance cards up to date. This way, people will know if they've over-allocated themselves. Better still is to use the dance card to avoid over-allocating themselves in the first place. 6. If team members can start a job early, do so. 7. If they can finish a job early without compromising quality, do so. 8. If a piece of the project can be delivered using a simpler or quicker approach, then do so. 7. O'Connell's Law. It's not a particularly common phenomenon, but when it happens, it's glorious. For want of a better name, I have called it O'Connell's Law. It says that once a team finds itself ahead of schedule, it will try to get even more ahead of schedule. So, if you can once get ahead of schedule, you get a snowball effect. The team want to pull ahead even further. If you can once get some traction using any of the techniques described above, you will find that the chances of your project coming in early increase enormously. What you need to read. How to Defend an Unpopular Schedule is an article by Steve McConnell, which can be found at www.stevemcconnell.com/art.htm. Steve is the author of numerous books on software project management. The article may be about software schedules, but the lessons are universal. www.helium.com contains some useful articles on managing stakeholder expectations. Go to www.helium.com and do a search on Managing Stakeholder Expectations. Getting to Yes, Negotiating an Agreement Without Giving In, by Roger Fisher and William Ury. Random House, 2003, is a great book on negotiation. If you like the idea of negotiating using the facts, as described in this chapter, this book will give you further ideas to develop your negotiating ability. Critical Chain Project Management by Lawrence P. Leach, Artec House, 2004, is not light reading, but if you're interested in shortening projects, shortening time to market, getting projects done in the shortest possible time, this book, based on the work of the brilliant Eli Goldratt, is a must. How to Run Successful Projects in Web Time, Artec House 2000, is another one of my books, and despite the title, this has nothing to do with web projects. Rather, it too is about shortening projects using ideas taken from the movie-making industry. Developing Products in Half the Time, by Preston G. Smith and Donald G. Reinertsen, John Wiley & Sons Limited, 1997, is another excellent book if you're trying to get projects done more quickly. If you only remember one thing, don't ever say yes to an impossible mission If you do, you will be condemned to a miserable project, and sooner or later, it will all end in tears. Chapter 6. Tracking and Status Reporting. What it's all about. Using the plan as instrumentation to drive the project. Managing people. Using different management styles. Dealing with problem people, stroke situations. The project manager's daily routine. Project meetings. Status reporting. Project postmortems. The Dirty Dozen. The 12 most common reasons why projects fail. Rescuing projects that have gotten into trouble. Using the plan as instrumentation to drive the project. If you think about it, what you do in chapters 1 to 5 is that you A, build a realistic plan, and then B, tell the stakeholders what's possible and what's not possible. As a result, you get agreement with them about how the project will proceed. Once the project begins, you have to do the mirror image of these two things, because now what you have to do is A, update the plan, and B, once again tell the stakeholders what's happening. So you see, the focus is always on the stakeholders, as it should be if your objective is happy stakeholders. Who said it? Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. Philip K. Dick. It was said earlier that the plan is a model of the project. In other words, it tells you what should be happening on the project. Then you want to ensure that what happens on the project gets reflected in the plan, so that the two things stay in sync over the life of the project. Another way to think about this is that the plan is the instrumentation you will use to drive the project. Managing people. In the course of your project, you will have to manage people. While this is not a book on how to do that, it should offer some guidance that will help you in this most difficult of tasks. So, this is what the next couple of sections are about. There is also a separate section on dealing with problem people, stroke situations. It's true to say that each of us, depending on our personality, has what could be called our natural management style. Some people are very hands-off. There's no point in having a dog, the saying goes, and barking yourself. In other words, if somebody has a job to do, leave them to get on with it and trust that they will do it properly. Then, on the other end of the spectrum, there are people who are very hands-on. Only by micromanaging everything do they feel that they're in control and can they be sure that things are on track. Which is right? The former sounds like a nice regime to work under. The person being managed can use their own initiative and creativity, but it sounds like things could go a long way wrong here before they were spotted. The latter regime sounds a lot more safe and secure, but it also sounds like it could be a giant pain to work under, or indeed to have to apply such a regime. The answer, of course, is that one size doesn't fit everybody, and that no matter what your personality causes you to do naturally, you're going to have to be a bit more versatile when it comes to managing people. The rest of this section offers some guidance on that. It shows you when hands-on is good and when hands-on can be a disaster. Equally, it shows you why hands-off is not always a good idea. When you assign a job to a person, what follows is a very simple way you could categorize the assignments. It comes from Chapter 3, from the section Harnessing the Strengths of the Team. Obviously, this scheme is somewhat arbitrary, but it will give you a framework within which to locate situations that you encounter yourself. Remember that the scheme was 1. Superstar. 2. Good citizen. 3. Don't report to me. 4. New to the job. 5. No availability. 6. Can't do the job. Now here's how to deal with these situations, irrespective of what your personality would cause you to do. Using different management styles. 1. Superstar. Just let them get on with it. Micromanaging this person is A, just going to upset, stroke, annoy them, and B, is a complete waste of your time. Leave them alone, and they'll come back to you when the thing is done. This is not to say to ignore them completely, but any interaction with these people is likely to be along the lines of, what are you doing for the weekend? Or, did you see the match last night? It is very safe to delegate to these people. 2. good citizen. With these guys, you're not going to be quite so blasé. You want to keep an eye on them, but not so much that it turns into micromanagement. So here's how that might work. Say they're working on a 3-day job, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You might go along at the end of Monday to check on things. What you'd like to see is A, some progress, maybe 5 of the 20 widgets have been processed or the first section of the document has been written, something like that, and B, that they have a little plan of how they're going to get to the end. They're saying, I hope to be this far by the end of Tuesday and then I'll finish it off on Wednesday morning with Wednesday afternoon for contingency. If they had made some progress and had such a plan, you could perhaps lighten off a little bit. Equally, if they hadn't and didn't, you might suggest a little plan to them and say that you check with them again about Tuesday lunchtime. So you can see, you can be very sensitive with this method, applying a little push where it's needed, leaving it alone where it isn't. 3. Don't report to me. It may sound that there's not a lot you can do here. In reality, there's lots. It starts out when you estimate the job in the first place. Get the person involved to give you the estimate. If they're known to be an incredibly busy or under pressure sort of person, or maybe even if they're not, query the estimate with them. Are they sure that they'll be able to do this? Can you depend on this commitment? Show them your plan and show them what the negative effect will be if they fail to deliver what they're promising. Then, as the time approaches when they must do this thing for you, send them a reminder, or remind them if you meet them in the cafeteria or the corridor. Then, perhaps the day before the thing is due to start, an email. I'll be good to go. Anything they need. Any excuse to nudge them again. You may be saying to yourself that you shouldn't have to babysit people in this way, but unfortunately, in project management, sometimes you have to in order to get the job done. Will all of this guarantee that they come through for you? Of course not. So, if it all goes horribly wrong, go back to them and reschedule the thing. Also, make it clear to them how badly this has affected you. If it's serious enough, you may have to put it in the status report, see below. And then, only if the person fails to deliver again, do you escalate it in some way, to their boss, to your boss, etc. So you see, rather than being powerless in these situations, there's plenty you can do. 4. New to the job. This is the situation that calls for micromanagement. A hands-off approach here will just cause problems. Not only that, hands-off would mean that you were guilty of throwing the person in the deep end to see if they sank or floated. Not a good idea. So here, we're talking hand-holding, nurturing, training courses, on-the-job training, shadowing them, keeping a close eye on them, correcting them when they go wrong, passing on the benefit for your knowledge in the hope that, as quickly as possible, they become useful members of society and you don't have to do that anymore. But notice that if they don't, and their report card would show this, then you're just going to have to keep on them. 5. No availability. Here you have a job, demand, for which you thought you had supply. Now it turns out you don't. Now you'll have to find it somewhere else. You'll have to do this job yourself, or somebody else will have to do it, or somebody will have to suck it up. This will involve you in lots of management effort, i.e. definitely not hands-off, until you sort out this problem. And if that person has a number of jobs to do on your project, and they've got an availability problem with all of them, then that leaves you with an even bigger supply-stroke-demand imbalance that you have to solve. Lots of hands-on here. 6. Can't do the job. Here you have two problems. The first is, as in the previous paragraph, how will you get this job done? How will you find supply to match the demand? But now you have the other problem of what are you going to do about this person? You've got a problem person or situation. Read on. Dealing with problem people stroke situations. Specifically, these situations are where you give somebody a job to do and, repeatedly, they screw it up. What are you to do in these circumstances? What follows is a 4-step process that you could go through in these situations. Step 1. The first thing to ask yourself is whether it is you and not they who is the problem. Did you make clear what you wanted? Were you available to answer questions or to clarify things? Did you give them the resources, people, equipment, materials, training, support, or whatever, to get the job done? Did you give them an impossible mission? Because if you're guilty of any of these things, then it shouldn't really come as any great surprise if they failed. Try to be honest here. It's all too easy to see the other person as the problem. But maybe the problem actually starts with you. If having done this, you find that you were at fault, then correct whatever you did and see what happens. Maybe the problem goes away. Step 2. If, however, the problem fails to go away, or you weren't at fault in the first place, then you need to move to this, which is where you come up with an improvement plan. An improvement plan is simply a list of actions that you, the company, or the person is going to take, along with dates by which those things are going to happen. And just to be clear, you're not talking long deadlines here, you're looking at a handful of weeks. While you, or the company, may do one or two things, organise training, or monitor more closely, things like that. The bulk of the actions will be undertaken by the person. In other words, the onus is on them to do the improving. This may solve the problem. If not, you go to step 3. Step 3 involves what you can think of as an extreme improvement plan, again with short deadlines. Basically, step 3 is an ultimatum and is pretty much all about the person. Take these actions, improve these things, or something very bad will happen. This may solve the problem. If not, then go to step 4. Step 4. This is where the very bad thing happens. It can range from moving them off the project team to firing. What you actually choose will probably end up being a function of A, the type of organisation you are, public sector versus private sector, for example, and B, the culture of the organisation. Also, it will almost certainly involve the human resources department, as indeed will step 3. Needless to say, all of the actions at each of the steps should be documented. The project manager's daily routine. The project manager's daily routine is a light way to track the project and update the plan. In one neat package, it does a number of things which are very important as you execute the project. These are: it provides a status check on the project. It enables you to drive the project forward. It gives you a structure within which to deal with firefights on the project. It enables you to record what actually happens on the project, compare this against your estimates, and use all of this to improve your estimating. It enables you to do change control, i.e. to make the right choice when changes occur on your project. And finally, do you have to do it every day? Well, we'll answer that question as well. Project meetings. Most project meetings may be seen to be a complete waste of time. They turn into talking shops where people who like the sound of their own voices can sound important. Or they end up as long rambling discussions about technical issues on the project, of little or no interest to many of the people at the meeting. Or the project team spend their time trying to give excuses as to why they haven't made more progress, or they try to imply progress that hasn't actually been made. How you need to do it. The project manager's daily routine. 1. Look down the plan from top to bottom and identify any task that requires some action by you today. 2. These are your to-dos on this project for today. 3. Do these actions. 4. For each task completed, record the results, actual work, actual start and end, actual duration, in the plan. These can be just extra columns in your Gantt chart. Any task on your project should only be regarded as being in one of two states, either done or not done. There should be no use of percentage complete or things like 90% done or we're nearly there, because the tasks have been broken down to the low level of detail previously described. This should not cause anyone a problem. However, a supposedly small task that remains not done for a long time should set alarm bells off. The task is clearly not as small as everybody thought it was. 5. For each incident, unexpected event, that occurs on the project, determine whether or not it's a big change. All of the following should be regarded as big changes. A. Changes to the scope, demand of the project, e.g., we don't want a glass, we want a swimming pool. B. Changes to the resourcing, supply, e.g., you can't have your two test engineers. C. Assumptions turning out not to be true, e.g., we assumed we would have to process 50 widgets, but it now turns out to be 100. D. For big changes, revise the plan based on the new conditions and present this to the stakeholders exactly as described in Chapter 5. The stakeholders then have a choice. They can accept the new plan with its new deadline, resourcing costs and all the rest of it. In this case, this new plan becomes the one you now work from. Alternatively, they can say that they don't want to go with the new plan. This must mean, then, that the decisions about scope, resourcing or assumptions will have to be reversed, and the original plan reverted to. 6. For each incident which isn't a big change, either use contingency to cover it or work more. 7. Check to see whether the date and budget have changed. If they haven't, then the project is on target. If they have improved, say nothing. If they have disimproved, then this is a warning sign. A single disimprovement by itself may not be a problem, since the slip could be corrected before the next time you run the daily routine. But if, on several successive runnings of the daily routine, the trend is not in the right direction, then this is a sign that you're in trouble. One way or the other, you need to communicate the resulting status to the stakeholders. How often should you hold project meetings? In most cases, weekly is the best. There may be occasions where you might want to have them more often than that. Say, for example, there was a critical project which had to go live on a certain date and was in its last couple of weeks. You might want to have daily meetings to ensure that there were no slip-ups in reaching the target. Do what seems sensible. If the meetings start to seem to be a bit pointless, maybe reduce the regularity. On the other hand, if lots of slip-ups are happening, then maybe you need more regular meetings. If you're going to have a project meeting, then it's important that everybody knows what the purpose of the meeting is. Typically, the meeting has three purposes. 1. To gather progress from the team so that the status report can be prepared. 2. To deal with any issues on the project. 3. To ensure that everybody knows what has to be done next. Allocate times for each of these, and you've got your agenda. Remember that a list of things to do is not an agenda. An agenda is a list of things to do along with the times allocated to each of these items. There's an example in Scoping and Planning a Project in a Day in Chapter 5. To gather progress from the team, go round each person in turn and find out whether the jobs they had to do in the period you're looking at have been completed. As discussed earlier, there is no third possibility. This should reduce significantly the likelihood of people rambling on about their work. Go round a second time. Find out if there are any issues which are holding things up or causing obstacles, and deal with them. In addition, ask everybody to calculate a PSI for the project, using any low scores to probe for further issues or problems. Go round a third time and ask each person to say what they're planning to do in the upcoming period. Get them to confirm that they have everything they need and that they have taken account of any dependencies on other members of the team. Finally, ask if there is any other business. Deal with it if there is, and you're out. There's an argument that you don't actually need project meetings at all. If you have worked your plan out to the level of detail described, if you're tracking it properly as just explained, and if each task can only exist on one of two states, done or not done, then why have a meeting? You, as the project manager, can go round and find out what tasks people have completed, and that's all you need. Notice, too, the value of doing this. You don't tie people up at a meeting that maybe isn't that relevant to them. They spend the bulk of their time working on their tasks to get the project done, which is exactly what they should be doing. Who said it? Trying is just a noisy way of saying no progress. Warren Bennis. Status reporting. Once you have determined the status of the project, you then need to communicate that to the stakeholders. You have 100% knowledge about what is going on the project, but is that what you communicate to the stakeholders? Absolutely not. There is stuff going on the project that you would probably never want the stakeholders to know. This then raises the idea that you are going to filter the information to the stakeholders. Specifically, what is meant by this is the following. If things are going well, and you will know this from your tracking, you need to tell the stakeholders that. But you don't want to say it in a hysterical, we could be coming in 3 months early kind of way. Instead, you just want to say, we're okay. We'll get back to you if there's a problem. Equally, if things are going badly, you want to tell the stakeholders that. But you don't want to spring it on them. You don't want them going along happily and suddenly open up a trapdoor underneath them. Instead, if things have begun to take a turn for the worst, you can start to get the stakeholders ready for that. As a result, if you then end up having to tell them that the schedule is going to slip or the budget is going to be blown, they're prepared for it and maybe have begun to make their own plans. Thus, it is possible to imagine a project that maybe went very wrong from the point of view of the dates and budgets and where one could still end up with happy stakeholders, provided you handled the stakeholders gently as just described. Your objective, then, will be to do exactly this. There's one other thing about status reporting that's worth saying. There's a Dilbert cartoon. You may have seen it. In it, Dilbert and his colleagues are having a meeting. The boss says, "Let's go round the table and give an update on each of our projects." Dilbert says, "My project is a pathetic series of poorly planned, near-random acts. My life is a tragedy of emotional desperation." The boss says that it's more or less customary to say that things are going fine. Dilbert says, "I think I need a hug." What the boss says is so true. It is more or less customary to say that things are going fine. And this is what most of the status reporting that you see and hear does. Let's look at some of them. The verbal ones first. You ask how it's going and you're told it's fine, or great, or everything's on target, or everything's under control, or the terrifying, we're 90% done, which generally means that 90% of the time has gone, not that 90% of the thing has been done. And then you get the written status reports that are full of things like tasks completed last week, tasks planned for next week, percentage complete, critical issues and so on. Lots of data, not a lot of information. So, if you're to do status reporting, it had better be useful and it had better be honest. The next section tells you how. How you need to do it. Status reporting. You need to do status reporting in three levels. Level 1 is a small amount of critical information. Level 2 adds extra detail, and finally, level 3 gives everything and the kitchen sink. Here they are in turn. Level 1. Are we on target or not? Are we going to hit the date or not? If the only thing you're tracking is the date, then that's all you need. If you're also tracking the budget and, or the work, person days, then you would also say whether they are on target or not. You could use what is known as RAG, or traffic light reporting. Green means you have a plan and you're running to the plan. Amber means you've drifted a bit, but you're taking steps to bring things back on track. Red means the plan is gone to hell and the project will have to be replanned. The only other thing that you might want to put in level 1 is what you can think of as I need help. This is where there might be an issue that is outside your control or authority to resolve. Maybe you need help from your boss or other stakeholders to get resources. Or maybe there is some roadblock in the project that you want help in removing because you're unable to do it. Or maybe you need a decision made. You don't care what it is, you just want it made, maybe by the stakeholders. If this was the case, then you would also put into level 1, what? Here's the issue. Action. Here's what I want done about it. Who? Here's who has to do this. Deadline. Here's when it has to be done by. Threat. Here's what will happen if it isn't done. So, for example, you might say, I need 2 test engineers by July the 31st. My boss is the person who has to get these. For every day they're late after July the 31st, the project will be a day late. Nothing like a threat to focus the mind. Level 2. What tends to be missing from many status reports is a history of how the project got to be where it now is. If you don't provide a history, stakeholders will provide their own. In general, if this happens, their history will not be favourable to you. So, for instance, supposing a project was meant to finish on September the 21st of a particular year, and it now looks like finishing on November the 29th. What will the stakeholders think or say? Almost certainly, they'll start to talk in terms of the slip. So, in order to avoid the scenario, you need to interpret the dates for them. You, and nobody else, needs to write the history and explain how the project got to be where it is. Here's how to do that. It's described for the date. If you're tracking the budget and or the work, then you would do it for those as well. For the date, you would say, here's what it was originally. Here's what it is now. Here's how it changed. You would have a line for each time the date changed, along with an explanation of when and why it changed. Level 3. Finally, in Level 3, you could give any remaining information that you think would be useful. This might include the plan on a Gantt chart, for example, the latest risk analysis. By all means, list tasks completed last week. This is good for team morale and showing progress to stakeholders. Tasks planned for next week is also good. It reminds the team that, however this week may have gone, they're going to have to do it all again next week. Who you need to know? Frederick Morgan. Lieutenant General Frederick Morgan was the man responsible for planning Operation Overlord, the invasion of Nazi-occupied northwestern Europe in World War II. The ultimate goal of this project was the destruction of German forces and the defeat of Germany. Morgan had to work backwards from that result to determine what manpower and material were required to complete the task. There had never been an amphibious invasion of this size, and Morgan and his staff had to plan the detail of the operation. In 1943 and 1944, while doing this planning, Morgan worked in a room over a shop in the West End of London. With a military assistant, he often went into a Marylebone hotel where he started debates among the customers about sending an attack across the Channel. He wanted to know what the ordinary civilian was thinking. He said, "Sound opinion is not the exclusive prerogative of those who are paid to give it." Send out your status report once a week, probably towards close of business on that week. This chapter talked earlier about RAG reporting, but there's also SAS reporting. It stands for Send and Scarper. So, you've got the picture. Your status report is there on your screen. Your bag is packed, you've got your hat and coat on, the engine of your car is running. Then, you hit Send. Run out the door before anybody has had a chance to read it and switch your mobile phone or BlackBerry off. Because, if you've planned it properly, tracked it properly, and reported it honestly, the stakeholders can't really ask for more than that. You're entitled to a life, and we'll be saying lots more about that in Chapter 8. Who said it? Human beings, who are almost unique in having the ability to learn from the experience of others, are also remarkable for their apparent disinclination to do so. Douglas Adams. Project Postmortems. It's a terrible name, and almost any name would be better. There are lots. Post-project reviews, post-implementation reviews. The military call them after-action reviews. In telecommunications company Ericsson, they're known as opportunities for improvement. Others call them lessons learned, do differentlies. The key thing is to learn something from a completed project so that you can carry this learning over to your next one. It has to be said that postmortems aren't done anywhere near as much as they should be. If the project was a failure, everybody just wants to forget about it. If it's a success, it's almost like everybody is so surprised they want to move on eagerly to the next big thing, and the post-mortem gets lost along the way. Sometimes, even when they are done, post-mortems suffer the same fate as those government reports that get produced from time to time and have lots of recommendations in them. The report ends up on the shelf, the recommendations are never carried out, and you might as well not have done the post-mortem in the first place. So, two sections follow. The first one describes how to do a post-mortem. The second one describes a light post-mortem that A, would have a good chance of being done, B, could be done very quickly, and C, would have a good chance of having its recommendations implemented. How you need to do it. A project post-mortem. 1. Tell everybody who was involved in the project, team, customer, management, and any other stakeholders, that you are doing a post-mortem to round out the project. ask them for a contribution. Tell them you want them to be blunt, and that all the submissions will be gathered together into a final document which will be published. Those inside the company will get the whole document. Those outside will get a version which has had any stuff confidential to your company removed. The latter allows you to involve the customer, subcontractors, or any other outside organisations, but still be the final arbiter of what goes to them. Participation is optional, and anonymity is allowed. 2. Give them some simple guidelines. 3. You're expecting 1 to 3 pages. 4. Essentially, you want them to write a "How was it for you?" essay. You want them to give their story of the project. 5. They should give both positives and negatives. What was done well, what was done badly. 6. You're particularly interested in any rules of thumb or other estimating type data that may be of value to other members of the team. 7. Ask them to list the number one or top two or three key lessons they would take away from the project. 8. Give them a closing date for submissions. 9. In the meantime, you write an objective account of the project. Write it like a police report. Confine yourself to the facts and keep your own opinions out of it. If you like, you can also write a "How was it for you?" essay, but make clear which is which and the difference between the two. Make sure you capture estimated versus actual data, i.e., here's what you estimated, here's what actually happened, so that you can see where your estimating needs to be improved next time out. 10. When all your material is in, gather it together. Generate the version for outside the organisation and publish both versions, the internal and external one. 11. You might also like to put the estimating data into some central repository where everyone can access it. If this is the first time this has ever been done, make a big song and dance about it. Your organisation's historical project database has just been born. 12. Ensure that somebody does something as a result of the post-mortem, e.g. an improvement project is put in place, or a single improvement is made, or the top three suggestions are acted on or something. Don't just let the audit gather dust. The Dirty Dozen. The 12 most common reasons why projects fail. During your project management life, you may come across projects that have gotten into trouble. If your job is to figure out what went wrong, then check the following Dirty Dozen first. There's a good chance that you'll find your answer here. 1. The goal of the project isn't defined properly. 2. The goal of the project is defined properly, but then changes to it aren't controlled. 3. Not all of the project stakeholders are identified. 4. Stakeholders are identified, but win conditions aren't. 5. The project isn't planned / estimated properly. 6. The project isn't led properly. 7. The project is planned / estimated properly, but then it isn't resourced as was planned. 8. The project is planned such that it has no contingency. 9. The expectations of project participants aren't managed. 10. The project is planned properly, but then progress against the plan is not monitored and controlled properly. 11. Project reporting is inadequate or non-existent. 12. When projects get into trouble, people believe the problem can be solved by some simple action, e.g. work harder, extend the deadline, add more resources. When projects get into trouble, the project needs to be replanned. How you need to do it. A light post-mortem. If you think that a full post-mortem as just described is unlikely to be done on your project, then make sure that you at least do a light one. Here's how to do that. You're going to do 3 things. They are: record the actual versus estimated. If you did the tracking as described above, then you will have the plan with the actuals in your hand on the day the project ends. In other words, no extra effort is required to get you this. Write down the number one, or maybe top two or three, thing that was done well on the project. Some little technique you developed, or template you came up with, or piece of knowledge you uncovered that really made a difference. Usually, postmortems tend to focus on things that were done badly. But it's also worth exploring what was done well. Often, we fail to realize the significance of certain things, and so we fail to carry those things over. So be sure to check it out. And once you have identified something, share it with your colleagues. In this way, you, but also the organization, may get some step improvements in the way projects are carried out. And then, of course, what was done badly? Again, maybe the number one or top two or three. What were the things which, had we known them, we would have done differently? Again, share it with our colleagues. It's a bit harder to do this. Nobody likes to admit to mistakes. But again, it might result in some improvement across the organization. Rescuing projects that have gotten into trouble. It may be that you get called upon to do a project rescue. If you do, then this is what you need to know. A rescue is needed when a project goes off the rails. The project was meant to go from A to B. It actually went from A to C. The first thing is to figure out what went wrong. Check out the Dirty Dozen first. It's almost certain your answer lies there. Also, do a PSI on the project as described in Chapter 4. This will point out to you the things that need to be fixed. Given that the project is now at B, you need to do a plan which A, fixes the things that need to be fixed, and B, puts the project back on target to get to C. You know how to build a plan. It's what's in the first four chapters of this book. So now you do this. Then you sell your new plan to the stakeholders as described in Chapter 5, and hey, you're up and running again. What you need to read. 4PM, a professional firm of practicing project managers, has a good article on tracking and reporting status on their website, www.4pm.com/articles. Project Perfect, www.projectperfect.com.au, also has useful information on the subject. Register at ganthead.com to get access to lots of project management things, including a good template for doing a project post-mortem. If you want to get serious about tracking large projects and their projects, then Project Management Accounting, Budgeting, Tracking, and Reporting Costs and Profitability by Kevin R. Callahan, Gary R. Stetz, and Lynn M. Brooks, John Wiley & Sons Limited, 2007, is a good book. If you need to know about the earned value method of project tracking, then Earned Value Project Management by Quintin W. Fleming and Joel M. Koppelman, PMI 2006, is your Bible. The One-Page Project Manager, Communicate and Manage Any Project with a Single Sheet of Paper by Clark A. Campbell, John Wiley & Sons Limited, 2006, is also good on status reporting. If you only remember one thing. A week is also a long time in a project. So at the very worst, track your project and report its status once a week. Chapter 7. Running Multiple Projects. What it's all about. The immutable laws of project management. Prioritizing. Defining multiple projects. The issues when running multiple projects. Careers in project management. What makes a good project manager? The immutable laws of project management. Now that you know how to run a project, it's time to introduce you to the immutable laws of project management. This is something that has been around for a while now, but much of it is chillingly true. While its authorship appears to be lost in the mists of time, it really should be compulsory reading for anybody involved in project management. Additional comments are in square brackets. Law 1. No major project is ever completed on time, within budget, with the same staff that started it, nor does the project do what it is supposed to do. It is highly unlikely that yours will be the first. Square brackets. Unless you do as we described in the preceding six chapters. Corollary 1. The benefits will be smaller than initially estimated if estimates were made at all. Corollary 2. The system finally installed will be completed late and will not do what it's supposed to do. Corollary 3. It will cost more, but will be technically successful. Law 2. One advantage of fuzzy project objectives is that they let you avoid embarrassment in estimating the corresponding costs. Square brackets. Apart from that there are nothing but disadvantages. Law 3. The effort required to correct a project that is off course increases geometrically with time. Corollary 1. The longer you wait, the harder it gets. Corollary 2. If you wait until the project is completed, it's too late. Corollary 3. Do it now, regardless of the embarrassment. Law 4. The project purpose statement you wrote and understand will be seen differently by everyone else. Square brackets. So make sure you get the stakeholders to sign it off. Corollary 1. If you explain the purpose so clearly that no one could possibly misunderstand, someone will. Corollary 2. If you do something that you are sure will meet everyone's approval, someone will not like it. Law 5. Measurable benefits are real. Intangible benefits are not measurable. Thus, intangible benefits are not real. Corollary 1. Intangible benefits are real if you can prove that they are real. Law 6. Anyone who can work effectively on a project part-time certainly does not have enough to do now. Square brackets. Availability is the silent killer of projects. Corollary 1. If a boss will not give a worker a full-time job, you shouldn't either. Corollary 2. If the project participant has a time conflict, the work given by the full-time boss will not suffer. Law 7. The greater the project's technical complexity, the less you need a technician to manage it. Square brackets. Incredibly technical projects can be run by incredibly non-technical people. This is because the currency a project manager deals in is jobs and whether they are complete or not. The techies will figure out the jobs and make the estimates, but they will almost certainly need help, guidance and training to do it properly. Corollary 1. Get the best manager you can. The manager will get the technicians. Corollary 2. The reverse of Corollary 1 is almost never true. Corollary 3. In general, great technicians make lousy estimators. Law 8. A carelessly planned project will take 3 times longer to complete than expected. A carefully planned project will only take 2x as long. Square brackets. A little planning is better than a lot of firefighting. Corollary 1. If nothing can possibly go wrong, it will anyway. Law 9. When the project is going well, something will go wrong. Corollary 1. When things cannot get any worse, they will. Corollary 2. When things appear to be going better, you have overlooked something. Law 10. Project teams detest weekly progress reporting because it so vividly manifests their lack of progress. Square brackets. See previous chapter on project status meetings. Law 11. Projects progress rapidly until they are 90% complete. Then they remain 90% complete forever. Law 12. If project content is allowed to change freely, the rate of change will exceed the rate of progress. Law 13. If the user does not believe in the system, a parallel system will be developed. Neither system will work very well. Law 14. Benefits achieved are a function of the thoroughness of the post-audit check. Corollary 1. The prospect of an independent post-audit check provides the project team with a powerful incentive to deliver a good system on schedule within budget. Law 15. No law is immutable. Square brackets. While many of these things might not, in the strictest sense of the word, be described as laws, they are things which occur over and over again on projects. Make sure they don't happen on yours. Who said it? Project management is like juggling 3 balls, time, cost, and quality. Program management is like a troupe of circus performers standing in a circle, each juggling 3 balls and swapping balls from time to time. Jeff Rees. Prioritizing. In this and the next chapter, you'll need to know about prioritizing, so let's define it here. There's some confusion about the term. Prioritizing is not saying that you have 5 priority 1 things to do, 19 priority 2 things, and 47 priority 3 things. Prioritizing is looking at a list of things and saying, if I could only do one thing, what would it be? That then becomes your number one priority. Then you repeat the question with the remaining list to give your number two priority, your number three priority, and so on. You can't have a joint priority, like a 7A and a 7B. Each item is either less important or more important than each other item. Defining multiple projects. In any discussion of multiple projects, it won't be long before you hear reference to the terms project portfolio management, program management, project office, and program office. What are these things, and how do they relate to what's already been talked about? While there are different and fancier definitions of project portfolio management and program management, it is perfectly acceptable to think of programs and portfolios of projects as being collections of projects. It is equally acceptable to think of programs and portfolios of projects as being nothing more than large projects. Another definition that is useful when thinking about the difference between program and project management is that program management is doing the right projects. Project management is doing the projects right. Project and program offices are departments or groups set up to support projects and programs. They can provide some or all of the following: documentation, standards, guidance, support, metrics, and policing. The issue with programs, portfolios of projects, and multiple projects tends not to be what they are called, but rather how they are run. Here's the way many organizations run. Maybe it sounds familiar. The issues when running multiple projects. A new year comes round, and the organization has ambitious plans for the year. Grow this by 15%. Reduce that by something else. In addition, there are a bunch of new things they want to try and do: products, services, initiatives. And so a bunch of projects, programs, portfolios of projects are launched to achieve all of these things. Many people already have a day job to do, and they are given a project load on top of this. The year kicks off, and almost immediately some project starts to fall behind schedule. People begin to work longer hours to get it back on track. Maybe this works. Maybe it doesn't. But whether it does or not, it isn't long before some other project starts to drift. Depending on its importance or who jumps up and down the most, resources, people, are shifted onto this project. That brings this one back on track, but inevitably, it causes slippage someplace else. The year continues like this, with everybody working harder and harder, constant switching of people between projects, major stress due to all of this. Finally, the end of the year comes round. Some projects get done and some don't. But it wasn't really the management that decided which projects would be done and which wouldn't. Rather, it just depended on what projects got into trouble, how people got shunted around, and who managed to put in the biggest effort and do the most sucking it up. Fate stroke luck running your projects? You said it. It's possible to get away from all this, using the ideas discussed already, notably supply and demand, planning before doing. It is possible to run the organization's projects such that the management takes back the right of deciding which projects get done, the projects are carried out successfully. How to do that is described in the next section. Who said it? Perhaps when a man has special knowledge and special powers like my own, it rather encourages him to seek a complex explanation when a simpler one is at hand. Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.